Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Think for a minute about what comes to mind when I say the name Soweto. Most of us have little trouble conjuring up images of a scruffy South African township, dirt roads, corrugated tin shacks, smoke. I think also of the history students confronting police, the classic photo showing the limp body of 13-year-old Hector Peterson, one of the martyrs in the opposition to the Bantu Education Act. But hang on a minute here. Nelson Mandela's election formally ended apartheid over 8 years ago. The new South Africa's not so new anymore. And yet, what many of us know is stuck in the images of the days gone by. It is in many ways the artists who help us understand what's new. Artists like Zakes Mda, who are writing and teaching the current works of African literature. We're starting a new series on The Connection today, a look at nations in the midst of change, how their stories are being told. Over the next few weeks, we'll talk about Russia, Mexico, China, but there's no better place to start than with South Africa, where the transformation itself was so sudden, so dramatic. Connection listeners, how much do you rely on the artist to show you the soul of his or her country? And do the writers lead the change, or do they reflect it? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is one of South Africa's greatest living talents. His plays have won numerous awards, his writing as well. He left South Africa, as did so many other exiles associated with the ANC, when he was just a teenager. He's now home again. His latest work, published in the United States, is The Heart of Redness. Zakes Mda is with me in the studio. Welcome to The Connection.
Oh, thank you.
Nice to have you here. You grew up in that Soweto that I described at the beginning of the program.
Oh, yes.
Did I get it right?
You got it right, definitely.
Has it changed?
Well, a lot has changed, of course, because most of Soweto, I mean, is not tin shacks and dead roads. Most of Soweto, I mean, you find real houses. And there are sections of Soweto, such as Deep Kloof Extension, where you find mansions, in fact. But, of course, we still do have other sections of the townships that are still tin shacks and so on.
Now, it's in part, I should ask you the question that I'm asking the listeners, whether or not it's up to the writers to lead the change or reflect the change. What do you think about that?
Well, writers can do both, in fact. You know, it's a symbiotic relationship, you know, between writers and society, because writers are informed by the discourse in society. But then they can also, you know, take the direction or put certain issues on the agenda.
Does that mean, Zakes, that it's now a more complicated story for writers to tell?
Oh, yes. It definitely is now a very complicated story. You see, the story before was a simple and straightforward one. Issues were clear-cut. They were black and white. And white was bad, black was good. There were no gray areas, you see. And, of course, the system of apartheid was so absurd in itself that it was possible just to take a slice of life, a slice of real life in Soweto, in Johannesburg, or anywhere else, and transfer it onto the page or on the stage and have a wonderful piece of literature, a wonderful piece of theater of the absurd. As an artist, you had very little role to play, in as far as imagination is concerned. Who created the work? Apartheid did. Apartheid was a creator. Now that apartheid is gone, we are now faced with the task of creating, the task of now using the imagination, because that great creator, apartheid, is no longer there. And of course, today, issues are no longer just black and white. where black was good and white was bad. We have good and bad on both sides. We have many gray areas. It has now become more complicated to interpret that society.
You know, it was simple for us as journalists, too. Maybe 10 years ago, I remember being in Alexandria Township, and I was just at a regular school doing interviews, and the teacher said, "Okay, students, now it's time for our tear gas drill."
Right.
And she lit a piece of newspaper, and we're running around this classroom waving this burning newspaper because the smoke would dissipate the tear gas. And the children all ducked under their desk. Mm-hmm. And I recorded this as a radio reporter, and I thought, my God, nobody at home is going to believe these 6- and 7-year-old kids just going through their routine tear gas drill.
It's a very absurd situation. The stuff that makes magical realism a literature. But it was real there. That magic, both good and bad, was real.
Almost like you didn't need an imagination. You just had to be a journalist or a reporter, just a cataloger of events.
In fact, you see, many of our writers of that period who depended on that type of reportage kind of novel writing or playwriting no longer write today because they never learned how to use the imagination. You see that? Of course, now we have a new generation of novelists, of writers, you see, who are emerging in this post-apartheid period and draw from the depths of their imagination to create, because the great creator, apartheid, is no longer there.
I want to go to the depths of your imagination here. Ask you to read something for us. This is the opening to the heart of Redness. And because it's the very beginning, I don't suppose there's much you need to tell us before you start. Let's just get a sense of your writing, if we can.
"Tears are very close to my eyes," says Bongo, son of Clemia. "Not for pain, no. I do not cry because of pain. I cry only because of beautiful things." And he cries often, sometimes just a sniffle, or a single tear down his cheek. As a result, he carries a white handkerchief all the time, especially these days when peace has returned to the land and there is enough happiness to go around. It is shared like pinches of snuff. Rivers of salt, they furrow the aged face. Bongo is different from the other unbelievers in his family, for unbelievers are reputed to be such somber people that they do not believe even in those things that can bring happiness to their lives. They spend most of their time mourning about past injustices and bleeding for the world that would have been had the folly of belief not seized the nation a century and a half ago and spun it around until it was in a woozy stupor that is felt to this day. They also mourn the sufferings of the middle generations. But, however, that is only whispered. Bongo does not believe in grieving. He has long accepted that what has happened has happened. It is cast in cold iron that does not entertain rust. His forebears bore the pain with stoicism. They lived with it until they passed on to the world of the ancestors. Then came the middle generations, in between the forebears and this new world. And the middle generations flitted by like a dream, often like a nightmare. But now even the sufferings of the middle generations have passed. This is a new life, and it must be celebrated. Bongo, son of Clemia, celebrates it with tears.
I hear the playwright in the writer before me.
Is that so?
Great performer.
Okay,
it's
well.
Lovely to listen to you read. Zeksimda, from the beginning of his book, just newly published in the United States, The Heart of Redness. Now, you keep referring in that to the middle generations. Is that the period of apartheid that we were talking about earlier?
Yes, because, you see, in this book, I'm looking at the past. But I've decided not to look at the immediate past, namely the apartheid past. I'm looking at the past before apartheid. And I've decided to forget completely in this story about the apartheid period, that is the middle generations, that is now in between the period I'm writing about and the present. So the novel is about, you know, the pre-colonial times and also during the times when Britain came in and then the post-apartheid period.
Now, the lead character in your novel, Kamagu, have I pronounced his name right?
Well, that will do.
Well, how do you pronounce it?
Kamagu.
Kamagu.
Yeah.
He's a bit like you. He comes back to South Africa after a long time abroad, and you spent many years in Lesotho in exile and then to the United
and
States.
And then in America and Europe. You know, yes, actually, many of his experiences are really based on my own personal experiences. So there is a lot that is autobiographical in as far as this character is concerned.
He finds, when he comes back to the village by the sea, Kolora, is that how you pronounce it?
Koloha.
I'm not even trying.
Yeah, well, in fact, the majority of South Africans cannot pronounce these words as well, because
it's Xhosa, right?
They belong only to that particular ethnic group, the Xhosa people.
Xhosa.
Yeah.
Now, he's torn between two women. One represents this past, and one represents the more modern South African woman. Is that an autobiographical part for you, the sort of indecision between the...
Well, that's the only part, or perhaps one of the few parts that are not autobiographical. Yeah.
But the idea that someone who comes back is tempted by the past as well as by what can be.
Well, you see, somebody who see some good in the past, especially in the heritage of the people, and who think that it can be harnessed, you know, into the modern world. In other words, modernity does not necessarily mean that you discard everything, even those values that are good, that have made a people a people.
So in your decision to pass over the middle generations, the period of apartheid, does that mean that those things that became symbols in that time, the ANC flag, Nkosi Sikelel, those disappear from the new South Africa?
No, they don't. In fact, that past, in other words, the immediate past, as I call it here, the middle generations, is just as important. In fact, it is even more important to talk about it today. I know that in South Africa, of course, you know, there is this feeling that we must not talk about the past and all that. But I think that it is still very relevant because it has informed our present. We are what we are today because of what has happened before. It was merely the fact that I was looking at a particular incident in history that happened before apartheid, namely the cattle killing movement, the Nonqause story, where a prophetess called Nonqause among the Xhosa people emerged. She was a young girl.
I'm going to stop you there because I want you to tell that story. It's
all
fascinating.
Right.
And we'll do that when we come back after the break. 1-800-423-8255 to join my conversation with Zix Mda. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. The first in a series of programs we're doing on the literature of changing countries, and South Africa is the subject of our conversation today. And the person who's helping us see through that is Zix Mda. He's author of a book just published in the United States this summer called The Heart of Redness. Those of you who are more up on books that are coming out in other parts of the world will know that he's got a book out since that called The Madonna of the Excelsior, available in South Africa. It's his fifth. The novel Ways of Dying was published in the United States also this summer, but he is perhaps as well, perhaps even better known for the plays that he's written. We Shall Sing, The Fatherland, The Hill, Broken Dreams, Joys of War, Ways of Dying. Recently working as writer-in-residence for the Market Theatre in Joburg. Currently spending this year as a visiting professor at Ohio University.
At Ohio University, yes.
Teaching African literature.
Teaching African literature and post-colonial literature, in fact,
Not specific to South Africa. Not teaching the Nigerians and the Zimbabweans as well?
I teach the Latin Americans as well.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, especially of the mode magic realism.
Well, that's a treat for you because you get to make that comparison that we were talking about earlier.
Yes, definitely.
Now, The Great Cattle Killing, 1856, this is central to the heart of redness.
This is central to the heart of redness because this is a period when a prophetess emerged amongst the Xhosa people who prophesied that the people should kill all their cattle and burn all their crops because at a certain date the dead would arise, you know, from the graves, and they would come with new cattle.
Is this a true story? Did this happen?
It is a true story. You see, this girl, who was about 15 years old, had quite a large following. You see, this was a religious movement with a very big following, people who were known as the believers. Then we had another section of the Xhosa people who did not believe these prophecies and refused to kill their cattle. They were known as the unbelievers. Then a big conflict emerged between the believers and unbelievers, which divided families, in fact. You would find the wife on one side and the husband on the other side and the siblings and so on. When the prophecies were not fulfilled, there was famine, of course, in the land, and almost two-thirds of the Xhosa population died as a result of that, you see. Now, I place my fiction in that historical context. And then I come back to the present and look at the descendants of the believers and unbelievers today and examine the conflicts of today in South Africa, which are no longer about religion, about prophecies, about killing cattle and so on.
It's economic development, economic and tourism. Protecting the environment.
Protecting the environment, which is one of the major themes, actually, in the novel here.
Now, the interesting turn that you put on it, Zix, is that because it is the believers who kill their cattle and they're wrong and they all... so many of them perish as a result of that. We're led to believe, or we're teased into believing that when we meet the descendants of the believers and the unbelievers, that still again it's the believers who are wrong and the unbelievers who are right. But you're not going to make it that easy for us.
Yeah, because well, in my personal view, because I mean, there's still a debate whether who's right or wrong there. Well, it is the believers who are correct in as far as advocating for the protection, you know, of the environment, you know, ecotourism and things like that, rather than the destruction of the natural trees in order to construct big buildings and factories and things like that.
Or at the very least, in the belief that there is some good to be drawn from the past, looking beyond the middle generations, the apartheid times, that there is logic in going back to the wisdom of the ancestors that came before that time.
Indeed. As long as we selectively do so, by the way, because there was also a lot that was wrong with the past, you see. You know, we must not be romantic about it, you know. We must be selective. There are values that are good, that we can come with onto the modern world. But there are others, you know, that are better off forgotten and discarded.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, Zeix Imda. We're talking about the way that literature can lead us to an understanding of a time or a place or a people. When we talk about South African literature today, I would imagine there are high school students who, like me, are handed a copy of Cry the Beloved Country and told to read that will teach us all we need to know about Africa. So we're interested in having you join our conversation about how it is that the new writers take us beyond that. And maybe I can ask Zeix you to give us just another short reading from the book. Mm-hmm. This is about Kamagu, the person who we spoke of earlier, your alter ego or your protagonist's yes. arrival in this yeah. in this village.
yes.
Anything that we needed to know about him before you begin to read?
Well, you know, he's disillusioned with the political situation.
In Johannesburg?
In Johannesburg.
Okay.
And was on the verge of going again for a second exile when he was attracted by a woman to the village of Qoloha by sea, which is where my narrative is set. So I think here, this is the place where...
He's just driving into town.
He arrives.
Okay.
Into this village.
Zeix Imda reading from The Heart of Redness.
As Kamagu drives his Toyota Corolla on the gravel road, he concludes that a generous artist painted the village of Qoloha by sea using splashes of lush color. It is a canvas where blue and green dominate. It is the blue of the skies and the distant hills, of the ocean and the rivers that flow into it. The green is of the meadows and the valleys, the tall grass and the usundu palms. He is pleased to see that there are some people here who still wear isiXhosa costume. There are few, though. Most of the men and women he passes on the road don't dress any differently from people of the city. It is said, he thinks, that when nations of the world wear their costumes with pride, the amaXhosa people despise theirs. They were taught by missionaries that it is a sign of civilization, of ubuqoboka, to despise isiXhaka as the clothing of the amaXaba, those who have not seen the light and who still smear themselves with red ochre. Even today, the civilized one condescendingly visit the clothes of the amaXaba and wear them as curiosities during special cultural occasions. As their everyday attire, the civilized ones wear German and Java prints that are embroidered in the West African tradition, but they still boast that they are in African dress. To them, African fashion means West African, and never the clothing of the amaXhosa or some other ethnic group of South Africa. Kamagu parks his car and walks into Volindlela trading store. There is a long line of people who are waiting to be served. He is not sure whether he should go to the counter and make his inquiry or join the queue. He thinks everyone is looking at him with suspicion. To them, he looks like the kind of person who thinks he's better than the common village folk and who will therefore jump the queue. He decides to join it.
Zeix Imda, reading from The Heart of Redness. The amaXhosa people despise their costumes. What do you think? I should tell, this is radio. You have this lovely shirt on today. It looked, I thought as you walked into the studio, I thought, I haven't seen a shirt like that since I saw Nelson Mandela.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But it's a long shirt. Is it linen, cotton?
Well, it is cotton, yes. It is cotton. But then it is not part of the amaXhosa costume, though. It is a contemporary African shirt that is inspired by some of the costumes from other ethnic groups of South Africa.
And it's exactly what Kamagu decides to get into, is encouraging the village women to set up this cooperative. Which is one of those things that, as you say, divides the believers from the unbelievers, the people who don't want anything to do with the costume and the clothing, and the people who think, hey, it's better than cleaning toilets at the hotel.
Definitely, you know. So there are those elements of trying to encourage the people to be self-sufficient, you know, and to draw from their heritage and actually benefit from it.
Zakes, when you write, are you writing for the people in South Africa? Are you writing for the people outside South Africa?
Well, you know, when I write, I mean, I never have that in mind. I never think that, okay, let me fashion my narrative in this particular manner so that it should be more accessible to these people or those people. You know, I just write the best way that I can, the most innovative way that I can muster. And then when the book has been published, then it defines its own readership. I would, of course, love if my books are read first and foremost by the people in South Africa, you know, and then, of course, the world in general.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're going first to Columbia, South Carolina. Barry's on the line. Hi, Barry.
Hi, Dick. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would like to get your guest's opinion on a statement by the wonderful Bishop Tutu. First of all, his reference to the apartheid and the disappearance and the euphoria that surrounded it, and indeed it should have disappeared long ago, but it's kind of, for me, reminiscent of the typical ending of the typical romance novel where the heroine and the hero kind of fall in love and agree to get married and, you know, they drive off into the sunset, but life is really only beginning at that stage. And what I'd like your guest's opinion on is what Bishop Tutu said shortly after South African independence, which was, the gravy train has finally stopped, but only to take on more passengers. And I asked the question, and I've had the great privilege of meeting Bishop Tutu years ago in Lusaka, but I asked the question in the context of kind of what has happened to Zimbabwe and to Zambia and to a lot of the other, you know, countries in that region. And I thank you for taking my call, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Barry. The gravy train has stopped, but only to take on more passengers.
Well, that's a typical Bishop Tutu. But he is correct. I mean, I do agree with him. And in fact, in this novel, I actually do show that in many instances, we have developed or are developing a new culture, especially amongst some of our leadership. And by leadership here, I'm not only talking of the political leadership, that yes, but also in other sectors of the society, the business leadership, for instance, that now there is that culture of entitlement that has emerged, and of greed. You know, there is...
But the people can be forgiven for that. I remember Nelson Mandela saying in his election, everybody's going to have a good house.
Oh, you do remember that? Yeah, well, that was a very stupid mistake. I think he regrets that.
Yeah.
I didn't think that there was somebody who would remember that, you know, because I actually saw that. I was in America here at the time. I was teaching at the University of Vermont, and I saw this on television as part of his campaign speech.
And you knew even then.
And I was shocked, and I thought, gosh, this is a very big mistake. But then I forgave him and said, well, you know, he's naive. He has just come back from prison. And he sooner or later, he will regret this statement because he has created new expectations that cannot be fulfilled. You see, he should have known that. But going back to this gravy train thing, yes, we do have, you know, strong elements of greed that have emerged instant. You know, there's this culture of instant
gratification, or
yes, instant gratification.
Or fulfillment, maybe.
Yeah. Yes, instant gratification in order to meet now our conspicuous consumption. You know, the new habits that have emerged with a new middle class.
This is Bonko. He goes to the store. Yeah. He says, I have no money, but you have to give me a tin of corned beef anyway.
Definitely. And this, of course, in some instances engenders a lot of corruption. But then, fortunately, again, in South Africa, we have very strong civil society. In other words, we have people like Tutu who will talk about it. There's me who will write about it. There is the trade union movement. There are different organizations, you know, and individuals and the press who are vigilant and who expose these things. The government itself has established structures, in fact, that expose corruption and deal with it. A lot of the corruption that you read about is corruption that has been exposed by those very government structures that have been established to do so, and is corruption that is being dealt with. So that is the only hope that, you know, the caller mentioned Zimbabwe and so on, that we are not going to take that path of Zimbabwe, precisely because right from the beginning, we did not deify our leaders. You see, we have exposed them to scrutiny. We did not say, these are the leaders who brought us liberation, so let them go scot-free, whatever they do. So we do have a very, very strong civil society, and we do not see, and I mean, how this, I mean, can just disappear.
Does it worry you, though, that at some point the dissatisfaction of the people would turn? So although it would not be Mandela, that like happened in Zambia, that the people eventually turned against Kaunda. They're turning against Mugabe in Zimbabwe right now. Does it worry you that this could happen in South Africa?
Well, of course, I mean, even today, I mean, there are many people who are disillusioned already. You know, I mean, that disillusionment will always be there.
But that's healthy. That's part of politics.
But that is healthy. That's what I was going to say. You see, it is very healthy to have that kind of thing and to have strong civil society as we have there. You know, the checks and balances, you know, there is nobody there, Mbeki or whoever, who can just do what he likes, as some of our dictators in other African countries and other countries actually outside Africa do, because this dictatorship is not only in Africa, by the way, you know. Oh, yes, even in some Western countries. But, you see, we do not see a situation whereby these people can just have free reign.
My guest is Zeke Zimda. Connection listeners, do you see the South Africa that we're talking about through literature? If so, what do you see? And how important is it to rely on the artist today to paint the picture that we're painting here? 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio, Zeke Zimda, author most recently of The Madonna of the Excelsior. That's not yet available in the United States. It will be soon. Published this summer in the U.S., The Heart of Redness, his most recent book, and available here, and Ways of Dying before that. 1-800-423-8255. And I remind you that this is part of a series that we're doing on The Connection about literature and countries that are going through moments of particular change and how it is that we understand both that change and the literature. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin, and Anne is joining us. Hello, Anne.
Hello. In 1984, I read a beautiful little book by J.M. Coetzee, a South African writer. He's white, but it was sort of an allegory of both a colonialism and apartheid, entitled Waiting for the Barbarians. And I thought that was one of the most beautiful books I had ever spread in my life. It's a very short novel, sort of magic realism in a sense. It doesn't name the country, and it's about a small colonial administrator who doesn't believe in what he's doing, and his country eventually decides the barbarians are coming. And
have you read the book since 84, Anne?
Well, yes, I reread it from time to time, but it seems to apply to what George Bush is after these days. I just, you know, it's a beautiful self-examination and a great description of paranoia on a national scale. And I wondered what your guest thought about that book.
Oh, yes, yes. I think very highly of this author, J.M. Mm-hmm. Cotier. In fact, I've read a lot of his work, and I think that, I mean, he's one of the very few, even during the days of apartheid, who was able to draw from his imagination,
yes,
rather than just to report on what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
He was not journalistic in his novel writing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But was very creative.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested if we look at Coetzee and Nadim Gordimer as examples of white writers at the time of apartheid. They were the black consciousness writers, poets. Steve Biko was, writing poetry at the time, was he not?
He wrote mostly political essays.
Oh, okay, all right.
And so on.
But
then, of course, there was a very powerful poetry movement during that period.
And we read it as writing of the white South Africans, writing of the black South Africans. And are those two camps still distinct?
Well, I mean, those two camps are still there in as far as the critics are concerned and the academics and so on. Because when you read reviews, when you read, I mean, you go to the academy, you find that writing is that they continue to categorize it in that manner.
Is that a mistake?
It may be, but sometimes, of course, I mean, it is a fact that there is black society and there is white society. You know, they have not just melted together all of a sudden after 1994, you know, and we still have different outlooks. Sometimes even polarization still does exist. In many instances, in fact, some people might even say that there is even more polarization today than there was 10 years ago, you know.
1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation. And thanks for your call. We're going to Raleigh, North Carolina now, and Zuka is on the line. Hi, Zuka.
Hi, good morning, Dick. How are you doing, sir?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Okay. I guess my question to Mr. Dar is that pre-colonial Africa witnessed the emergence of great writers like Dennis Brutus, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o from Kenya, and Wole Soyinka from Nigeria. And after independence was achieved, it looked like, or it seemed like, great writers either disappeared or were marginalized by this continent and the social structure there. How much has the world's social and political an economic order affected emerging writers of social change in their continent?
Well, in fact, I think my view is quite the opposite. It is true that during the colonial period and the immediate post-colonial period, we did have the wonderful writers that you are talking about. You know, the Achebes, the Ngugi Wa Thiong'os, and the Dennis Brutuses, and so on, who became quite well known. But writing did not stop in Africa. In fact, we have a new generation of writers today, you know, who are very, very talented and have created wonderful works of art. I'm thinking here of writers like Yvonne Vera,
yes, sir,
from Zimbabwe, you know, Chinjerai Hobe from Zimbabwe. In fact, a lot of Zimbabwean writers today, what one can call the boom of contemporary African literature, you know, is Zimbabwe today.
Are these writers writing in Zimbabwe? Are they all expatriates, exiles?
They are writing from Zimbabwe and are based there and are published in the United States here as well, you know. I know, for instance, Yvonne Vera is published also by my publishers, FSG.
We'll have a link on our webpage so people can check out some of these writers and their works.
We have in Nigeria writers like Bendele Thomas, B. Bendele Thomas. We have Ben Okri, who not long ago won one of the most prestigious awards, the Booker Award.
Yeah, but Ben Okri has been basically residing in London for the past 20 years.
Well, that does not make him less of an African, you know, wherever he resides. You see, when I talk of African writers, I'm talking of writers who live in Africa and who live even in the United States here or anywhere else. But Ben Okri, in fact, can even be referred to as more of an African writer than many writers who write from Africa, in that he uses cosmologies of his people in Nigeria to create a very contemporary African literature. You see, he has gone back to the deep heritages of the traditions and the cultures and the customs of the various ethnic groups of Nigeria, something which is not even done by some writers who write from Nigeria itself. So the fact that he lives in London, you see, does not make him less of an African writer. But then the point that I'm trying to make is that we have a new movement of African writers that perhaps may not have come to your attention yet, but who are there and are very, very powerful indeed.
What is the, do they have a voice that or a way of describing their writing that covers what it is they're trying to deal with, a way that you would describe them as a teacher or a critic?
Well, you see, well, of course, I mean, some of their works, I mean, are indeed political. So some of their work, you know, do critique their societies or the African society in general or the world. But now, unlike the previous writers that the caller has mentioned, who were referred to as African writers, and this African writing was still exciting because it was something new. Now, these writers I'm talking about fall in the much bigger pool of what is known as post-colonial writer or writing. You see that? That's where they're categorized now, and they belong together in the same pot with the Salman Rushdies and the Arundhati Roys,
B.S. Naipaul, Rohinton Mystery.
Yes, and the Australians, the Peter Currys, and so on. You see, they do not stand now on their own as African writers, but as post-colonial writers.
And the place that these people use as a mailing address is something that, in your view, is not that important. That Rohinton Mystery happens to live outside Toronto doesn't make him less of a writer about life in Bombay, for example.
Definitely. Especially if his concerns are life in Bombay, and he writes about life in Bombay.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you care to join my conversation with Zig Zimda. One of the things that fascinates me about the way that you describe the life of the people in Kolora is that it's ordinary.
Yes.
That the people there are going through the ordinary business of life, whining about the white tourists, complaining about the fact that they don't have jobs or they don't like their neighbors. And I was reading it and thinking to myself, maybe that's one way of describing the big, or not the big, but one big shift that the writers of South Africa are dealing with today, or perhaps just Zeke Zimda dealing with today, that rather than it being life in a fantastic, unbelievable, sort of cartoon-like existence with apartheid. Now you write about what are ordinary, everyday concerns that...
Oh, yes. Because, you see, the demise of apartheid freed the imagination of the writer. And now we are able now to explore and look at other issues. We are able to use the words of one of our writers in South Africa there, we are able now to discover the ordinary, to rediscover, in fact, to rediscover the ordinary.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And so is it easy to get published now as it was in the middle generations, in the apartheid times?
Well, in the apartheid times, it was easier to get published.
Easier to get published?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
Because there were publishing houses such as Raven Press that were set up to publish such works. Publishers who did not depend on commercial success, mm-hmm. who depended on donors, on European donors and so on. And they could publish anything that came their way, you know, and have a long list of books that they've published. Merit counted, but not that much, you know. All they were interested in was, well, the money was there to publish the books. You see that? Now, why it is more difficult is because such publishers are no longer there. The donor community disappeared immediately after 1994. We have many publishers in South Africa, more than 100, 200, in fact, you know, many, many publishers. But all of them, of course, are publishers who must have a market.
Make a profit.
Yes. You see that? They publish in order to sell and make a profit. And they publish works on merit now, you see. Not just because they shout the right slogans.
So although...
As was the case before.
Although it may be more difficult, what you're saying is that for writing, it's a good thing because they're making those decisions based on merit?
For writing, it is a good thing. But of course, you know that sometimes... There might be some work which is so experimental yet good, which some publishers might say, oh, well, you know, we won't be able to sell this, therefore we won't publish it. So in as far as that is concerned, it is bad. But generally, I mean, for a writer like myself, I mean, I have publishers knocking at my door every day because publishers are hungry for new work, you see, especially work that sells like mine. You see that? So there's no problem in as far as that is concerned.
Do the novels sell better than the plays?
Well, they do, actually. That's why I now focus mostly on writing novels, because, you see, I earn all my living from writing. You see that? My plays are not the popular kind of plays such as the plays, say, of Mbongeni Ngema, you know, of the Sarafina fame and so on. My plays are very experimental and therefore have small audiences. And, of course, I would not be able to earn a living from them. I do them for the sake of art, you know. Novels is both for the sake of art, but also I earn my living from them.
It's been so great to have you in the studio with me.
Well, my pleasure.
Zeg Simda, his most recent novel, published in the U.S., is The Heart of Redness. A previous novel, Ways of Dying, is just out in paperback. Now, Connection listeners, if you're in the Boston area, Zeg is giving a lecture at Harvard University's Barker Center. That's this afternoon at 4:30. Special thanks to Maureen Isaacson of the Sunday Independent and Stephen Klingman of UMass at UMass Amherst. Join us at the same time next Thursday. Our World Literature Series continues. Next up, Mexico. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR. Here and now is next with news and a special report on a referendum in